Portfolio Construction Forum presents Ron Temple, February 2017.
We're at a critical turning point for investors in the world economy. 30 years of global convergence are over. Think back to the 1980s. Since that time, we've had global trade convergence, global monetary convergence, and we have free flow or a liberalization of global capital flows. I believe that has ended emphatically. And the big question is, are we just stalling or are we reversing? I believe there's a 25% chance that we are indeed reversing and going from global convergence to global divergence. There are meaningful implications whether we stall or whether we reverse. And the most important one of those, I believe, for investors is that inflation, we have seen the lows. Now, either in we're stall mode, then we'll see inflation grind higher. And where for the last seven to eight years, we've worried about whether inflation will be 0.5% or 1.5%, I think our lens needs to shift to wondering if inflation will be 2% or 3%. Might not sound like a big deal, but the last time we saw 3% inflation in the United States was 1995. There's a generation of investors who don't know what inflation even really looks like. If, however, we're at a reversal, that 25% tail risk, which is a very high probability for a tail risk, we may see a step change in inflation rates to something more on the order of 3 to 4 or 4 to 5%. Now, how will we know if this is happening? We'll watch three key milestones: populism, which it seems you might be hearing a lot about these days, protectionism, and prices. And then I'll talk about what this means for investors. So let's start with a bit of history. In terms of global trade convergence, you can see that trade in goods and services as a percentage of global GDP has risen from about 12% of GDP back in the 1960s to 30% by the time of the global financial crisis. You can also see that that line basically stalled out and recently has started to drift a little bit lower. As trade basically improved, part of the driver of that was that we all embraced free trade agreements. Now, what we've shown you on the left is the average tariff across developed economies. And on the right, we've shown you tariffs in emerging economies. Now, the right-hand chart is much more extreme. And you can see back 25 years ago, the average tariff in emerging economies was about 30%. It has declined to 10%. Now, what's also interesting, by the way, in case you're kind of curious, that these lines seem to have been quite low for the last 10 or 15 years, trade agreements have changed in the last 10 or 15 years from focusing on tariffs to non-tariff barriers. And so if you look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it was not about tariffs, it was about intellectual property protection and other key factors. So the world has been on this track for 30 years, and as we've reduced tariffs and non-tariff barriers, we've seen companies take advantage of this and make their global supply chains more sophisticated and, frankly, more complex. So what you see here is in the gold line, for any export from an advanced economy, over 60% of the value of that export was in and of itself imported from another economy first. So effectively, you have components crossing borders multiple times, even in the case of China, which is in black, where 45% of the value of their exports actually came from other countries as well. So companies have actually taken advantage of these global supply chains, and at the same time, investors have done the same thing. So if you look on the left-hand side, you can see world foreign direct investment as a percentage of GDP. And you can see it's gone from 10% to 35% of GDP in the last 25 years. On the right, you see actually capital flows in the form of financial assets, so much more fluid, in the US have gone from less than 10% of GDP to over 50% in the last 25 years. So effectively, we've had global trade convergence in terms of tariffs and non-tariff barriers, companies extending global supply chains, and also seeing capital move freely around the world to arbitrage any difference we could find as global investors. Now, at the same time that happened, we've seen global monetary policy convergence. Now, step back for a moment and think to 30 years ago. How many independent central banks were there in the world? Not that many. In the Eurozone, by the way, there were a lot more central banks than there are today, at least ones that matter, because the ones that executed monetary policy. Maybe the Bundesbank was independent, maybe the Bank of Italy, not so much. Now, what's interesting is in the last 28 years, we've seen central banks become independent, they've established inflation targets, and typically, as you can see on this graph, they've established them around the same level. So New Zealand was the first country to establish an inflation target in 1989 at 2%. If you look across on the horizontal axis, we show you the year in which inflation targets were adopted in various countries, and then on the vertical axis, the level of the inflation target. So across developed economies, the target is almost always 2%, except in the case of Australia, Norway, and Iceland, where the range is 2 to 3% over a cycle. Even in emerging markets in the gold dots, we have inflation targets of 2 to 5% with one outlier, which is Ghana. And I think it's pretty important to note that even Ghana has an inflation target, which is 8%. So this is an orthodoxy that has been adopted around the world. And that, in part, has contributed to a convergence of inflation and interest rates. Now, on the left, we show you the inflation in 20 developed economies. The line in the middle shows you the median level. The gray, though, shows you the range between the 10th percentile economy and the 90th. So effectively, we took 20 economies, dropped one low reading, dropped the high reading, and gave you the range. Go all the way back to the 1980s, where Italy might have run inflation at 10%, maybe Germany was at 3%. You had a very wide range of outcomes. But over time, that has converged, in part because of the orthodoxy I just explained, and also because investors around the world have gained a confidence that central banks actually can control inflation. And that has led to the right-hand chart where you see 10-year government bond yields for the same 20 countries, drop the top one, drop the bottom one is the gray range, and you can see that those numbers have converged as well. Now, as I think about this, this has actually all been very interesting, and there have indeed been some winners. Now, the next few charts are going to show you are from a World Bank study published 2 years ago, and it's a very interesting study, where the authors took the world population and looked at the income distribution globally in 2008. So they effectively ranked the lowest income individual all the way to the top in income. And then they did the same thing for 1988 and compared the two numbers to effectively see how much did incomes change at different parts of the income spectrum. So the horizontal axis shows you the percentile of global income. So let's start with the 55th percentile because that's the high part of the graph. The person who was at the 55th percentile of global income in 2008 basically made 75% more in real terms than the person who was at the 55th percentile of income in 1988. An amazing outcome. And if you look at the 35th to 70th percentile, you see all of the workers there had at least a 60% improvement in real terms in income. Now, this is pretty phenomenal. If you're wondering who those workers are, 90% of the 35th to 70th percentile is in Asia, with a large number of them being in China. And this all makes sense conceptually. As we know, many manufacturing jobs moved offshore to low-cost centers. Now, that's great, but unfortunately, there's a trade-off. There were also some losers. So if we look at the 75th to 99th percentile of the global income distribution, you can see the gains weren't so good. In fact, they were zero for the person at the 80th percentile. So who's in the 80th to 90th percentile of this chart? The majority of people who live in the US, Europe, Japan, Australia, and Canada. Now remember, this is 2008 versus 1988. This is before the global financial crisis. So even without a financial crisis, a large part of the population in wealthy developed economies saw zero real benefit from the globalization of the prior 30 years. In my view, this is critical, not just for the next 2 to 4 years, but the next decade or longer. Now let's finish the chart. The far left end, sadly, is Africa, in large part, where the lowest 1 to 5% basically of people saw very little income gains at all. And interestingly, the far right end shows you the 99th percentile of income. So where we had great success in terms of lifting the well-being and the standard of living for people in emerging Asia, we also saw the global capitalist, many of them being in this very room, at the top 1% of the world spectrum, benefiting from owning the companies that could take advantage of that labor cost arbitrage to increase profit margins and net profit in total. So a very uneven situation. Now that has given rise to populism across Europe and the US. And so here I just show you a map you're probably very well aware of. The countries in red are countries that already voted in a way that we view as populist and against the trend before of global convergence. Spain is in light blue because the government there is not completely stable yet, and then we have three other countries with upcoming elections. Here's the US at a county level in terms of the 2016 presidential election. Now, you might well know that Hillary Clinton did indeed win the popular vote by about 3 million votes. But I thought it was interesting here is that out of 3,112 counties, she won 490. Now, she happened to win the counties with a lot of people in them, the cities and other areas of the country that are more liberally inclined. But it's amazing to me that there is a broad red swath of the country that not only voted against Hillary Clinton, but in fact, in my view, voted to tear up the documents and the foundation of that global convergence that lasted for the prior 30 years. They don't want change on the margin. They want revolutionary change, which is why they chose the president the U.S. has today. Now, that will lead to policy consequences, and I want to focus on a couple of these. Priority number one for the Republicans is repealing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. So right now, that is the focal point of much work in Washington, D.C. And although, yes, people in Washington can do more than one thing at once, the second priority is corporate tax reform. And I want to hone in on corporate tax reform because I think this is a critical part of global convergence turning into divergence through protectionism embedded in the corporate tax code. So let's start at the good part of the story. If you look at this chart, what I've shown you is the combination of the statutory tax rates in the US for federal, state, and local taxes. And you can see the US dot is the highest dot on the chart at a 39% corporate tax rate. Now, by the way, keep in mind this is the statutory rate, not what companies actually pay. Now, the US has the third highest statutory tax rate in the world. The only two countries that are higher are the United Arab Emirates and Chad. Now, if we look on the chart, you can see Australia at a 30% corporate tax rate at the far right end of the spectrum. What the horizontal axis shows you is what percentage of GDP is collected through those corporate tax rates. So Australia is just below 5% of GDP, but the US is at 2.25%. So how, if the US is so much higher on the tax rate, are their revenues so much lower? It's largely because of loopholes and exemptions. So what I think is very admirable from the Republicans in Congress is they want to streamline this tax policy, reduce that 35% to something more like 20%. And where they're absolutely right is small businesses get affected most negatively by these high statutory rates. They don't have the lawyers and accountants to figure out the loopholes and exemptions, and they don't have enough money to lobby congressmen and fund their campaigns. Hence, they lose. So this is good. The only challenge of taking that tax rate from 35% to 20% is it cost about $1.8 trillion of lost revenue over 10 years. So how do you pay for it? The proposal that's gotten the most traction in Washington so far is a border adjustment tax, which could raise between $1.2 and $1.3 trillion over that same period of time. So how does a border adjustment tax work? Effectively, what it means is if you have revenue in the United States, you can no longer deduct any expenses incurred outside of the United States against that revenue for your tax purposes. It is effectively a tariff on imports and a subsidy on exports. So let me explain how this works. So imagine a very simple hypothetical company with a little bit of revenue, $100 of revenue, $60 of expenses, $40 pre-tax. At a 35% tax rate, they pay $14. They have $26 left over. That's the current code of federal taxes. Now imagine with the border adjustment tax, if we have the same company and they do everything domestically, they sell domestically, they produce domestically, only thing that changes is their tax rate goes to 20%, they pay $8 of tax, and they effectively have $32 of after-tax income left over. A great outcome. Let's say, unfortunately, however, that there's a company that sells its products in the United States but imports everything it sells. Well, because they can no longer deduct the cost of their imports, for tax purposes, they now have $100 of taxable income in the US. They have the $60 of their cost of goods sold, which they can't deduct. So they pay $20 of taxes and ultimately end up with an after-tax income of $20. So they actually lose, even though the tax rate got cut 1,500 basis points. This is a tariff. Now imagine a company that produces everything in the US and sells them to Canada or Australia under a border adjustment tax. There's no tax on the revenue outside the US, but you do get credit for the fact that you spent money in the US. You effectively get a subsidy on those domestic costs. So in this case, there would be no tax to be paid because there's no US revenue, but there would be a $12 tax credit for that loss you incurred domestically, and your net income goes to $52. This is a critical part of what's going on in Washington, in my view, and it's a critical result of populism bleeding into protectionism. Now, what are the odds this will pass? I think it's around 50%. President Trump early on said he didn't really like the idea, but he seems to be warming up to it. Yeah, as you can imagine, lobbyists are all over this. 97% of the clothing sold in the US is imported. Retailers hate this idea. But this is a sign, in my view, of things that might come. Even if it's not a border adjustment tax, protectionism is alive and well in the halls of Congress as a policy we should pursue. Now, even if we don't have a border adjustment tax, I do think it's important to recognize 2.5% of all the products traded globally now have temporary trade barriers. So a creeping form of protectionism that might push up cost. And at the same time, again, even if we just have global convergence stall out, we're seeing wage inflation in the US. So where we had wages on the black line at around 1.5% wage growth in 2013, That has accelerated to around 3% at the end of 2016. So again, inflationary pressure rising. And then last here, what you see in the blue line is the inflation in the US for goods, excluding energy and food. And you can see since about 2000, it's been about a zero, because we've benefited from deflation, from importing from cheaper and cheaper sources of production. If global convergence has stalled, maybe that deflationary push is no longer there. If you look at the black line, you can see service inflation in the US has been about 3%. So what I'm trying to get across here is whether we've stalled or not, we see creeping higher or grinding higher of inflation on the back of wages, on the back of no longer being able to go to the next cheapest supplier, and on the back of a range of other factors we can discuss later. To set the framework then, there's a 25% chance that global convergence is turning into global divergence. If that's the case, I think there is a risk of a step change in inflation. But even if global convergence has merely stalled out, inflation is likely to move higher over time. We haven't seen high inflation in decades in the US. I think this is critically important to investors in terms of asset allocation and security selection. So what are the questions you should be asking? And I want to leave this for you to think about your own asset allocation and portfolios. And these are questions we've actually gotten from investors. So number one, are inflation and interest rates likely to stay lower for longer? A year ago, I would have said yes. Today, I would say no. As I mentioned, I think we've seen the lows in inflation, and that will feed through to interest rates and has big implications for your bond allocations and also for the stocks you own that might have been safe haven bond proxies. Number two, is policymaking going to be predictable? Well, with the Fed, they were very good at telegraphing a few meetings in advance what to expect. But when you have a commander-in-chief who passes policy through Twitter, predictability might not be a strong point. So I don't think we can count on that, and I think this will lead to more dispersion, including an example I'll show you in a moment. In terms of bonds are safe, again, hopefully that's clear, they might not be so safe. Maybe there's no credit risk in sovereign bonds from developed economies, but there is interest rate risk. And I think we should reevaluate if they even have a role in your asset allocation at all. And then last, is value dead? We've seen a long period of time, 9 years of growth outperforming value. I think we might be at a turning point there as well. I'm going to leave these other assumptions for you to look at when you get the materials later, but I think the key point is the questions we all ask need to change. So to the point of dispersion going up, what you can see on the top frame here is the change in equity markets since the US election. US small caps at the top, up 14%. MSCI Latin America down over 3%. At the bottom, we show you the dispersion within the US, within the S&P 500. Financials up over 16% on a range of optimism. But then you see at the bottom, consumer staples, utilities, REITs were all a source of funds to fund those more cyclical, value-oriented stocks at the top. I said I would give you a specific example. This is my favorite. Two railroad companies, both based in the US. In blue, you see basically Kansas City Southern. Their rail line runs north to south. They have a lot of volume related to automobiles crossing the Mexican, US, and Canadian border. Stocks down 7% since the election. The gold is Union Pacific. Their rail lines run east to west. They carry a lot of coal. Their stock is up 18%, a 2,500 basis point spread since November 8th. This is the kind of dispersion I think we could see, though perhaps to a lesser magnitude in the future. I mentioned correlations have gone down. In the US, we've seen correlations collapse to the lowest level in over 7 years. And in Europe, we've also seen correlations come down. And by the way, we looked at Australia and Japan. Similar story, different magnitudes. I mentioned basically value versus growth. If you look from 1978 to 2008, value basically trounced growth, except for the TMT bubble. But since 2008, we've been in an unusual environment where people were desperate for yield at any price and for any growth they could find. In a world that might be turning more inflationary with higher dispersion and lower correlations, this might be a chance for us to see a major inflection back toward value and fundamentals in that regard. And that would have implications for low volatility stocks, which you see in blue, which even after a recent sell-off remain very expensive relative to history and relative to the market, and might be a positive opportunity for the higher volatility. Think companies that are more cyclical, again, often more value with more inflationary protection embedded, who are vastly undervalued relative to history and could converge quite a bit, if not reverse this valuation situation. So to wrap up, I think what we've seen is a major change in what's going on in the world. 30 years of global convergence having ended, I do think tail risk on both the left and the right end of the spectrum have increased. I also believe that we are looking at a risk of about 25% of convergence going to divergence. But even if convergence merely stalls, inflation is moving higher. And that should change our mindset in terms of asset allocation and in terms of deflation risk versus inflation risk. I will acknowledge 2 to 3% inflation doesn't sound like very much, but it is a very different proposition from 0.5 to 1.5 when you're buying a 10-year government bond with a 2.7% yield in Australia or 2.4% in the US or well below 1% in Germany. Those asset allocation decisions have to be reevaluated. And so I would propose basically three primary questions you should be asking yourself when this is over. Am I basically taking into account the risk factors that we might see in terms of asset allocation, inflation, and the winds of change in general? If inflation does go higher and grind higher over the next 3 years, even in the more optimistic scenario, am I protected from that? And if we do see global divergence, am I in a position to profit from that divergence through my asset allocation and security selection?